ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। नारायणं नमस्कृत्य नरं चैव नरोत्तमम् देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासम् ततो जयमुदीरयेत्। नष्टप्रायेषु अभद्रेषु नित्यं भागवत सेवया भगवति उत्तमश्लोके भक्तिर्भवति नैष्ठिकी कृष्णे स्वधामोपगते धनमज्ञानादिभिः सह कलौ नष्टदृशाम् एष पुराणार्कोऽधुनोदितः। Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 5, entitled The Meeting of Nanda Maharaj and Vasudeva. Today we'll discuss text number 30. We'll also recite texts 31 and 32, which finishes this chapter. So please repeat.
Nunam hi adrishta nishtha अयम् अदृष्टपरमाः जनाः अदृष्टम् आत्मनः तत्त्वं यः वेद न स मुह्यति नूनं ह्यदृष्टनिष्ठोऽयम् अदृष्टपरमो जनः अदृष्टम् आत्मनस्तत्त्वम् यो वेद न समुह्यति नूनं ह्यदृष्टनिष्ठोऽयम् अदृष्टपरमो जनः अदृष्टमात्मनस्तत्त्वम् यो वेद न समुह्यति नूनं ह्यदृष्टनिष्ठोऽयम् अदृष्टपरमो जनः अदृष्टम् आत्मनस्तत्त्वम् यो वेद न समुह्यति नूनं ह्यदृष्टनिष्ठोऽयम् अदृष्टपरमो जनः अदृष्टमात्मनस्तत्त्वम् यो वेद न समुह्यति नूनं ह्यदृष्टनिष्ठोऽयम् अदृष्टपरमो जनः अदृष्टमात्मनस्तत्त्वम् यो वेद न समुह्यति नूनं ह्यदृष्टनिष्ठोऽयम् अदृष्टपरमो जनः अदृष्टमात्मनस्तत्त्वम् यो वेद न समुह्यति नूनं ह्यदृष्टनिष्ठोऽयम् अदृष्टपरमो जनः अदृष्टमात्मनस्तत्त्वम् यो वेद न समुह्यति लेडीस् नूनं ह्यदृष्टनिष्ठोऽयम् अदृष्टपरमो जनः adrishtam atmanastatvam yo veda na samuhyati nunam hyadrishtanishtoyam adrishta paramojanaha adrishtam atmanastatvam yo veda na samuhyati nunam. Certainly, he indeed, adrishta, unseen, nishta, ayam, something ends there. Adrishta, the unseen destiny, paramaha, ultimate, janaha, every living entity within this material world, adrishtam, that destiny, atmanaha, of oneself, tatvam, ultimate truth, yah, anyone who, veda, knows, na, not, saha, he, muhyati, becomes bewildered. Translation. Every man is certainly controlled by destiny, which determines the results of one's fruitive activities. In other words, one has a son or daughter because of unseen destiny. And when the son or daughter is no longer present, this is also due to unseen destiny. Destiny is the ultimate controller of everyone. One who knows this is never bewildered. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Nanda Maharaj consoled his younger brother Vasudev by saying that destiny is ultimately responsible for everything. Vasudev should not be unhappy that his many children had been killed by Kamsa, or that the last child, the daughter, had gone to the heavenly planets. I'm going to read ahead now that just to finish the chapter. There are no purports for the verses that follow, so we'll return to this one. Sri Vasudeva Uvacha Korovai Varshiko Datto Ragnye Drishtavayam Chavaha Nehastheyam Bahutitham Santi Utpatash Chagokule. Vasudev said to Nanda Maharaj, "Now, my dear brother, since you have paid the annual taxes to Kamsa and have also seen me, do not stay in this place for many days. It's better to return to Gokula, since I know that there may be some disturbances there." Text 32. Sri Shuka Uvacha Iti Nandadayo Gopaha Proktas Te Shorinal Yuyufu Anobhir Anarud Yuktais Tam Anugnyapya Gokulam. Shukdev Goswami said, after Vasudeva advised Nanda Maharaj in this way, Nanda Maharaj and his associates, the cowherd men, took permission from Vasudeva, yoked their bulls to the bullock carts, and started riding for Gokula. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta purports to the 10th canto, 5th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled The Meeting of Nanda Maharaj and Vasudeva. Om Ajnana Timirantasya Jnananjana Shilakaya Chakshurun Vilitam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Nama Shri Chaitanya Mano Bhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Gadamahyam Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guroho Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunathanvitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakhanvitam Shcha. He Krishna Karuna Sindho Dina Bandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hare Priye Vancha Kalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, 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 Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Nunam hi adrishta nishthoyam, adrishta paramojanaha, adrishtam atmanas tattvam, yoveda nasamuhyati. Every man is certainly controlled by destiny, which determines the results of one's fruitive activities. In other words, one has a son or daughter because of unseen destiny. And when the son or daughter is no longer present, this also is due to unseen destiny. Destiny is the ultimate controller of everyone. One who knows this is never bewildered. Here, Srila Prabhupada's purport is not exactly a literal translation. Sometimes it's seen that in Srila Prabhupada's purports, he will weave statements from the commentaries into his translation. And that's what he's done here. You cannot criticize Srila Prabhupada for not translating this verse literally, because Krishna himself recommends in Bhagavad Gita the way that we understand the Shastra is through the spiritual master, and by extension, the spiritual master's predecessors, the previous acharyas. They've given their comments in order to understand what the verse means. And so Srila Prabhupada is not just representing the verse alone, literally. Rather, he's representing the meaning of the verse, which is the real purpose of the verse. So that we see here. In fact, there's more of Sridhar Swami and other acharyas' commentaries in the translation here than there is in the purport. So that might explain why Srila Prabhupada also said that actually his purports are more important than the verses. So anyway, the idea here is adrishta nishto ayam. This thing that they're talking about, ayam means this. It is the ultimate determinant here. Adrishta. What does adrishta mean? We've heard the translation already. Something unseen. But actually, this is a very important word in philosophical jargon. It's a very, very important word. And it's also called apurva. We have six ways to interpret Vedic literature. There are six classical systems of philosophy. And Mimamsa is one of them, or rather Mimamsa is two of them. Because Mimamsa simply means to examine carefully or to discriminate carefully. And Mimamsa began with the school of Vedic interpretation called Purva Mimamsa. Purva means the beginning of something. It's also called Karma Mimamsa. Their concern was how to interpret the instructions given for Vedic sacrifice, Chodana. Their view is that the Vedas consist of nothing but instructions. It doesn't matter what the Vedas mean. You have to follow the instructions. And in a way, we agree with this. Because Bhagavad Gita, we know, we can understand Bhagavad Gita in so many ways. There are so many different commentaries on Bhagavad Gita, but the ultimate purport is what? What is Arjuna going to do at the end of that conversation? He's going to lift his bow, and he's going to fire that bow. He's going to do something. So this is their logic. Anyway, then later on, they say, I mean, these are eternal philosophies, actually, but from a scholarly empirical point of view, they say that later on, people began to be concerned with the meaning of the Vedas. Well, what is it actually? Why are we doing this sacrifice? So that is called Uttara Mimamsa, later Mimamsa, better known as Vedanta. And, of course, the ultimate conclusion of Vedanta is not impersonal, but bhakti, pure devotional service. Therefore, it's Bhakti Vedanta. So we're studying the Bhakti Vedanta purports here. But just a word about Adrishta. In the Purva Mimamsa system, that is to say in the Karma Mimamsa system, which originally began as a school of Vedic interpretation, and the principles of interpretation or Mimamsa, hermeneutical principles, those are still accepted pretty much in all the six schools, including ours. So it's an important thing to consider. So Adrishta in that system means the unseen link between what you do and the experience that you have to undergo as a result of what you've done. We can say maybe that means karmic reaction, but, and in a most general sense, as here in the translation also represents, unseen destiny. Destiny means really there is no arbitrary destiny, it's what we've done. What have you done in the past that created the experiences that you're undergoing now? So those are good experiences, or they may be bad experiences also, but either way, you cannot see it. No one can trace it out. This is part of what Krishna means in chapter 3 of Bhagavad Gita when he says, Bodhivyam chavikarmanaha. The sinful activities, you cannot, they're not to be understood. A bodhivyam. Gahano karmana gati. The ways of karma are inscrutable. For that reason, it's also called adrishta, unseen. Finally, another reason why it's called apurva is because you don't see the result before. You see the result later. Apurva. Purva means, the word purva, anybody know? Purva means previously. You don't see the result first, you see the result later. You have to have faith in things that you cannot see. If it's not manifest in any way beforehand, then you have to accept it on faith. So therefore it's called atrishta or apurva. So this is a very important concept in all Vedic philosophy, particularly in the Purva Mimamsa. Why is it called Purva Mimamsa? Therefore, because they're concerned with what you do first. Purva means first, previously. Okay, so this is just a little background. Actually, Prabhupada explains this word. I'll just read for you quickly in one of his fifth canto purports. He's talking about Maharaj Bharata. And Maharaj Bharata was very much concerned with executing Vedic rituals. In fact, Purva Mimamsa rituals, Karma Kanda rituals. And Prabhupada explains in these purports here that he's not to be criticized for that because his actual purpose was to satisfy Vasudeva, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, by performing those rituals. Krishna himself, in the beginning, say, 4 or 5 chapters of Bhagavad Gita, takes enough pains, we might say, to encourage Arjuna about the importance of these things. Anyway, so Maharaj Bharata was exemplary in that way, and his viewpoint was, his logic was, that if we are massaging the legs of our spiritual master, then we are also massaging our spiritual master. Right? You can't say that, well, you're not serving your spiritual master, you're massaging his legs. That's not logical. So in this way, Maharaj Bharata was engaged in Vedic ritual. But to explain what is apurva, Srila Prabhupada writes as follows. A devotee may have a priest perform some karmakanda, and the priest may not be a pure Vaishnava. But because the devotee wants to please the Supreme Lord, he should not be criticized. The word apurva is very significant. The resultant actions of karma are called apurva. When we act piously or impiously, immediate results do not ensue. We therefore wait for the results, which are called apurva. The results are manifest in the future. Even the smartest accept this apurva. So that's that. Now, Nanda Maharaj is trying to stress to Vasudev, who he assumes might be in distress about the loss of how many children? Seven. Yesterday we heard what happened to one. Sa divam gata. That girl went to the heavenly worlds. We don't know how, but she became a drishta, you might say. She disappeared. And similarly, the other six were killed, actually, by Kamsa. That we do know. So Nanda is thinking in this way, beginning from text 29, the acharyas commenting on this passage say that Nanda Maharaj is trying to console Vasudev, who he assumed is maybe lamenting for the loss of his children. But what Nanda has no idea about, by the agency of Yoga Maya, is everything that Vasudeva has just been through in the preceding days. You can imagine. You don't have to imagine. We know. He and his wife, of course, were imprisoned for a long time. Then they also don't know their own history. That's also adrishta. Their own past history of austerities in which they prayed ardently that they might have the Lord as their son, and he fulfilled that desire in this birth. When he appeared to them, then they knew, okay, this is the result of my past activities. Not in a karmic sense, but in a devotional sense. So anyway, Nanda Maharaj, he was just glad that Nanda hadn't figured out what he had done, because he came incognito and he replaced the child, as we know. So he was glad about that, and he had a lot on his mind. But Nanda is assuming that he's just thinking about the loss of his children, so he saw a need to console him. But Vasudeva, on his behalf, was instead thinking, my God, what fortune this man has, my brother, Nanda Maharaj, who has the Supreme Personality of Godhead as his son. I prayed for this. I executed billions of years of austerities to get the Supreme Lord as my son, and yet he doesn't stay with me. So Nanda Maharaj is not thinking like that. In fact, we heard yesterday, if you try to tell Nanda Maharaj the whole story, he probably won't believe it. So none of us really has insight into the experiences of another person. But those experiences are what shape our personalities. That's also part of this adrishta. Adrishta, you can say, means aprarabdha karma, karma that has not begun to manifest yet. What are the divisions of this aprarabdha karma? Anybody know offhand? It's described by Srila Rupa Goswami in his Bhaktirasamrita Sindhu and explained in the commentaries. Aprarabdha karma has three subdivisions. What is the difference between prarabdha and aprarabdha karma, first of all? Prarabdha karma means that karma which we are undergoing in this life. That's visible. That's drishta, you can say. Aprarabdha karma is adrishta. You can't see it, but the effect is definitely there. How is the effect there? Well, how do you think? What's your mindset? What kind of personality do you have? What are your desires? What have your experiences have been? How does that taint your thought processes? How does that color your personality or your outlook on life? You see? This is part of it. So three categories. First of all, you've planted a seed. The analogy is given of bij, karma bij. Bij means seed. When you plant a seed, that is the action that you've performed. That's the purva aspect of it. You've done something. So what happens when you plant a seed? Is that the end of it? No. I mean, in this world, sometimes seeds don't fructify, but In the karmic scheme of things, the seed always fructifies. There's no duds. So you plant that seed, and what happens then? If there's sunshine, if there's soil full of nutrients, if there's water, what will happen to the seed? It will fructify. So the aprarabdha karma means you've done something, but the result is adrishta. You don't know what it is. It's not come yet. You have no idea what's happening. We all forget everything all the time. So, but then the seed fructifies at some point in time. Think about different kinds of seeds. You have mustard seed, tiny thing. You have avocado seed, big. Different kinds of seeds. They all fructify with different kinds of plants. Some of them produce fruits, some of them only flowers, some of them are just, you know, empty, as it were. You see, all different kinds of seeds, and actions are like that. Some actions fructify immediately. A potato, you don't even have to plant it. Everybody, when you're in school, they make you do this exercise, correct? You put a potato in a glass of water. Did everybody do this when you were young? Yeah, everybody does this. And the thing fructifies. It starts sprouting roots. You see? Some seeds, they say, they fructify after hundreds of years. They're sitting in the ground before they fructify. So action is like that. So how can you untangle this thing? What you've done in the past, you can't even remember what to speak of. Figure it all out. You see? And similarly, just as some seeds produce a poisonous plant, a poisonous fruit, like castor beans. Don't cook those for dinner. You see, they're poisonous. The most highly poisonous toxin known to mankind, practically. Anybody know? Ricin. It comes from castor beans, castor oil, or castor plant. You see? Others produce apple. Apple, the doctor says, if you eat an apple every day, your health will stay good forever, practically speaking. You see? So actions are like this also. We have to suffer something, we have to enjoy something based on the seed that we've planted. So when that seed fructifies, you still don't see the result, but it has fructified. The result is going to come. It's just like if you get on an airliner for New York City from Los Angeles, LAX. As soon as they close the doors, they'll announce, we're closing the doors, flight attendants, take your seats. At that point, you're going to New York, barring an act of God or Al-Qaeda. You're going to New York. So action is like that. So when the action has been performed, it's been planted, and then it fructifies. We still can't see it, but there's something growing there. And it's going to mature in due course of time. When it comes above the ground, then we see, oh, there's some trace of this activity. That's what it's like when you can see that I have certain tendencies. A person who's introspective and sensitive and intelligent and concerned will see, well, why do I want the things that I want? What makes me do the things that I do? Why do I have the preferences that I have? This is all because of what we call samskara. Samskara means the impression that's put upon your mind by performing any activity. As we said, just like with the fruits of action, so the samskars, they may be good samskars, that's called susamskara. They may be bad samskars, called kusamskara. But either way, anything you do is going to produce a psychological result. So that's the second of these three phases of aprarabdha karma. The third phase is that it's actually, the plant has actually matured and is producing some fruit, but that fruit is not ripe yet. You see? So that's another phase of the karma. We can feel that, or we can see sometimes, even in another person, this person has a tendency that's going to cause him to suffer. Person has done some sinful activity in the past, it's created an indelible impression in the mind that cannot be easily erased, and therefore that person is practically compelled to act in the same way again. This is why Narottam Das Thakur says sense gratification is like poison. You're poisoning your own mind by engaging especially in sinful activities. because it makes it all that much harder to give up. The attachment becomes solidified. So that's the third stage of aprarabdha karma. But none of these things are actually tangible. They're all adrishta. They're all apurva. When does it become drishta? That's when you have to undergo the reaction. You see? You have to undergo the reaction. And all the experiences that we have to undergo in life, Nanda Maharaj is telling Vasudev, it's based on this. No one can escape this. This is why Krishna says, Daivi hiesha gunamai mama maya duratyaya. You cannot get out of this, he says. Well, why do we... Devamrita Maharaj was giving a lecture on this point. He said, here in L.A., so a few years ago, he said, we're in prison. Why do we think that Durga Devi is called Durga? What does Durga mean? Anybody know? Fortress. Impregnable. You can't get in, you can't get out. It's a closed system. Now, if you try to escape from the fort of Maya, or from any prison, when I was in New York, we were going to a program, upstate New York, and we saw this high security prison. My God, it was frightful even to look at. High, high walls, barbed wire, guard posts with guns poking out of them. Pretty daunting scenario. So when we're in prison like that, that is this material world. When we're imprisoned by what? By our own samskaras, by our own karmic reactions. The seeds that we've planted, we've got to eat them at some point. You see? And do you think you can get out of this very well? Not easy. No, you really can't. It's virtually impossible. When we try to escape from such a high maximum security prison as that, then immediately, Maharaj was explaining, all the resources of the prison are focused on those prisoners who are trying to make their break. All the guards are focusing their attention. And same way, Maya will put all of her attention. And you cannot compete with any goddess, especially Durga Devi. She's in charge of all of them. The whole thing. Durga. So, this is our unfortunate situation. Of course, Nanda Maharaj and Vasudev, they're not within the control of karma, but it looks that way. It looks that way. This is the artifice of Krishna's Leela. It's all constructed in such a way that if you want to accept it as mundane, it's very convincing. Yes, this is all just ordinary things. And that's what the Mayavadis do, unfortunately. They think that this Krishna Leela is all still part of Maya. Sanatan Goswami, in his commentary, has said something about this. He says, Manushya Leelaya Iveti Gnyam. It should be understood that this mutual discussion between Vasudeva and Nanda Maharaj, it's just part of the Manushya Leela, Krishna's or human-like pastimes, because it becomes sweet. The more Krishna acts like an ordinary child, it becomes sweet for his devotees. That's what Vasudeva and Devaki were praying for, but even they didn't get that good fortune of enjoying the Bala Leelas of this, the Supreme Lord. The Leelas which are going to really open in the next chapter, and from then on we'll see. The incredible bliss that Nanda Maharaj and Yashoda Devi were able to enjoy in the service of the Lord by dint of their devotional service. Of course, they have this eternal disposition. And in a sense, you can say Vasudeva and Devaki are not different from them. They take different forms. They have their Mathura form. They have their form in Svarga Loka. They have their earthly form. And they have their eternal form as Nanda Yashoda. So, this is his point. Every one of us is controlled by destiny. In the Hitopadesh, there's a nice shloka to this effect. Likhitam abalalate pranchitam kaha samartha means whatever is written on your forehead, how can you possibly get over that? In the Shastras, we find that sometimes it's stated that our karma is written on our forehead, as if in some sort of indelible barcode that only the devas can decipher. But they're very powerful. They can do this. They can actually decipher these things, and they move us around like chess players on a chessboard. according to our own actions. The devas themselves are not independent, therefore it's foolish to worship them for the fulfillment of material desires. And Krishna rightly says, yajanti avithi purvakam. It's not enjoined to do that. Is that literally a true statement? Is it? Is it literally true that no one is enjoined in Vedic literature to worship devatas? Yeah, that's right. But Krishna says this. Yajanti avithi purvakam. There's no vidhi determining. There's no vidhi that you have to worship them. This is, you can interpret it that way, or you can say, although the vidhi is there, but it's basically, it's against the principle. The principle being surrender to Krishna. Yathataror mulanashechanena ityadi. Just as when you water the roots of a tree, its water will automatically be distributed. So, like this. People worship devatas because they don't know that the devatas themselves are not independent. But we learn this from which book? Famous book of ours, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu brought back from South India, Brahma Samhita. In that book we hear about how many demigods? At least, maybe 3, 4, 5? Durga, Ganapati, Shiva, Indra, Surya also, so many. And all of them are, it's, all of them are illustrated in terms of their dependence on Krishna, their subservience to Krishna. This is the idea. So Krishna, when we're not interested in direct submission to his desires, then Krishna works indirectly through his Mahamaya energy, and Mahamaya also works indirectly through this Adrishta. Okay, you don't want to see things as they are? Okay, so that Adrishta ho gya. It becomes invisible to you. You see? But this thing has control. Just like something we see, even in this world, a very good manager, sometimes he doesn't tell everybody working under him exactly what's happening. There is a plan, but not everybody knows what it is. You see? Everybody does their part, and then the whole thing works. As long as everybody remains submissive, then everything works very nicely. So this is how Maya organizes this material world. Now, here he also says an interesting thing. Adrishtam atmanas tattvam yovedana sambhuhyati. The truth of the self here, in fact, Prabhupada even translates it as the ultimate truth of the self is this adrishta. Adrishta. How is it so? And yoveda nasa muhyati. Somebody who knows this is never bewildered. Acharya's commenting here, they say, what that actually means. Never bewildered means he's not overcome by lamentation. Just like Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, right? Dhiras tatra na muhyati. Right? If we have knowledge, then you can elevate yourself beyond the vicissitudes of fate. Vicissitudes means sometimes it goes this way, sometimes it goes that way. Sometimes we're elated with ecstasy and giddiness, and through which we become foolish and then entangle ourselves. And sometimes we're overwhelmed by trauma, extreme suffering, such that we don't want to live any longer. People kill themselves sometimes. It's increasing, actually, nowadays. You see? These are the different poles of this same process of adrishta. Some unseen force is making you undergo these things. You see? And you cannot fight it. But if you have knowledge, atmanas tattvam, yo veda, nasamuhiti, that person will not be bewildered. This is why we say that Uttaramimamsa is better than Purvamimamsa. Vedanta philosophy is superior to Karma Mimamsa, because in Karma Mimamsa you cannot get out of karma. You have to keep going up and down. Kalidas says in his Megadutta, like the spokes of a wheel. What is the significance? One split second the spoke is on top, the next it's on the bottom. What is the significance of it eternally? Nothing. You see? But if you can elevate yourself through knowledge and realize that I don't have to suffer in this way, then you become freed. That's called mukti, liberation. And ultimately, there's escape alone is not really the goal. There's a purpose to all this. That purpose is also adrishtam. It's Krishna. Krishna himself is like, you can say, fate, in that he's in control of our fate. But our ultimate destination, atmanagati, is Krishna himself. We want to reestablish our lost but eternal relationship, now dormant, with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So this knowledge is important, because without knowledge we cannot persevere in devotional service. We will become overcome by trauma. We will become distracted by elation, you see. Will not be steady. Therefore, these things are important. And even Nanda Maharaj is preaching this to even Vasudeva, although they're both eternally liberated souls, but they're setting the example for us. You see? Okay, so destiny is ultimately responsible for everything, but ultimately destiny is in the hands of Krishna. And nobody can argue with Krishna. If Krishna wants to change something, he can do it. Who are the examples of this? Sanatana Goswami in his purports, commentaries on these verses, says Jamadagni is one example. Satyavan is another example. These are people who are dealing with adrishtam, dealing with their karma was to die at a certain point. But by divine grace, they were carried across, you see. So, Baladev Vidyabhushan Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur also says, Vipatsindhu Tiryatam. This world is like an ocean of reverses. You have to undergo suffering. No matter how good your karma is, it's going to end eventually. And at that point, Viveka Pote Naiva, your only boat to free you from suffering is the discrimination, along the lines of what Vasudeva is speaking here to his friend, Nanda Maharaj is speaking to Vasudeva here. We have to reason like this. These are the points. We find this knowledge again and again in the Vedic literature. So I'm going to stop here, but if anybody has any questions or any comments, Shachitanoi, please. Let's get a microphone, because those of us who sit happily in the class have no idea how irritating it is for those in internet world who cannot hear the questions. I listen to class every day, and it's very irksome. You don't know what the question is, you only get the answer. So we're going to wait for the microphone. No mic. So then speak loudly and I'll repeat your question.
If you take initiation, the spiritual master will absorb your reactions. Mm-hmm. And another verse that came to me was the Devarsi Bhuttapta Nainam Pitrinam Nakinkaro Rayan Rinicharayam Sarvatmano Yosaranam Sarakam Katomukundam Parehita Kartam. We're not indebted anymore. It's yes. Like you're absolved, you surrender to Mukunda, the one who gives liberation.
Yes.
So, but it appears in one sense that devotees come and you see sometimes, they look very surrendered, and sometimes some of them, you know, they go through the most, you know, like...
I'll take it a step further than that. Very much of the time we see that the more advanced someone is, the more that person suffers. What are some of the examples? Obviously we have the Pandavas, but even more than that, what about Prahlad Maharaj? What about, I mean, so many times, gopis. Who suffered more than the gopis? You see? So there's a few reasons for this. In the case of these Nitya Siddhas, their suffering is affected directly by Krishna himself. And we don't want to discourage anyone from taking shelter of Krishna, but, you know, think about Yashoda. everything is fine, the Lord is lying happily on a blanket underneath a cart. Outside, she's going about her housework. In the course of her chores in the house, she looks out the window and sees that there are big black clouds roiling and boiling and looking very ominous. So she thought, I better go out and get Krishna. So then, and bring him in, because it's going to rain or something. If you live in Vrindavan, you know that every April at the end of the monsoon, it gets like this. This Trinavarta-type clouds come in, and it's a big mess. Dust storms everywhere, and it can be injurious. Sometimes they're quite forceful. So she saw this. By the time she got outside, Trinavarta had already come and taken her child far into the sky. This is how Krishna treats his devotees in the spiritual world. But that's not our point here. We're talking about karmic suffering. That suffering is a different matter, and it's inconceivable to us at this point, because it's actually ecstasy. How is it ecstasy? Like dry ice. What kind of ice will burn you? Only dry ice. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says it's actually, although it's not burning you, it does burn you. Ice cannot burn, but dry ice will burn, you see. So in the same way, he says, the suffering of the spiritual world, it looks to be suffering, and they themselves also call it suffering. But it's actually transcendental ecstasy of an intense degree. And we can't understand that, only because of our lack of experience, because of our lack of surrender, you see. So that's one half of the coin. The other half of the coin is what we are familiar with. That is this adrishta principle that we've been discussing. We do have to suffer in this world. And that suffering is the result of our karma. So to answer your question more directly, Jiva Goswami gives this answer in his commentary on Bhaktivedanta Sindhu. He says, if you have 100 pan leaves stacked up and you push a long needle through them, in India, we have these needles that are about 6, maybe a foot long. They make garlands with them. So it goes through the palm leaves immediately, correct? Yes? No. It actually goes through the first leaf, then the second leaf, then the third leaf, then the fourth leaf, all the way until you 99th leaf, and then with 100th leaf, you're done. You see? Immediate is relative. We say it's immediate. Because you push it through, it's done. But actually, that's, we're looking at in terms of human time calculation. You see? Which is relative. Relative to what? Relative to adrishta, our own karma. You see? So we have to suffer. That's why sometimes it's seen that devotees suffer. Now, another way to answer this question is that as soon as you're initiated, if you do nothing else, impelled by your own conditioned nature, then it's true. You're instantly liberated. There's no karma. You don't regain anything. But we're not like that. We're criminal. We have a criminal mentality. And therefore, we still do things, whether we're aware of it yet or not, because we will become aware of it in due course of time. The nature of spiritual advancement is that we become increasingly aware that I've got a lot more work to do, you see. But whether we're aware of it or not, we are going to act on the basis of our own conditioning. It's inevitable. And Prabhupada therefore gives the analogy like a fan. Electric fan, when you pull out the plug, it takes some time to slow down. You see? Similarly with our nature, it's like this. And that's sometimes we actually initiate new karmas that we have to deal with later on, because Krishna doesn't have the obligation to accept the reactions for that on our behalf. It's like when you're working for a company. You can be handling hundreds and billions of dollars if you work for, say, Merrill Lynch or some investing firm. But as soon as you put even $1 south, so to speak, as soon as you put it in your own account, then you're culpable and the company's not going to accept responsibility for you, you see? So it works like that also. So in the world of karma, for those of us who are still conditioned souls, we are freed from all obligations to the devas, to the sages, to our forefathers, etc., if we are pure devotees. Until we are pure devotees, the Bhagavatam 11th canto advises, it's a good idea to follow those Vedic injunctions that elevate you to the sattva-guna, until you're freed from the tendency to do things that are rajasic or passionate or ignorant. Does that answer your question? It's a few different answers, but I think it... Is that okay? Okay. You sure?
Yeah.
Okay. Bhrigupati Prabhu.
Thank you, Prabhu. Yeah. Let's see. At one point in your class, you made the analogy about in the prison, when somebody tries to break out, immediately all the resources of the prison are focused on...
All the guards, all the government, they call the police outside, everything. Yeah, electrified.
Right. Okay, and along those lines, Prabhupada says, at least in two places, in two different purports in the Bhagavad Gita, that something to this effect, that when one tries to engage in devotional service, it's like declaring war against the illusory energy, and that Maya will come up with more things to try to entrap that person.
Yeah.
Okay, so my question is this. Trying to get out of a prison by breaking out of a prison... Okay, I can understand how the prison would retaliate by, trying to come down on you and get you. But when engaging in devotional service seems to me more like cooperating with the prison rather than trying to rebel and break out of the prison. Mm. So why is it that when somebody's trying to engage in devotional service, which is, would seem to me to be equivalent with cooperating with the prison, becoming a good prisoner, so to speak, why is it that, one is engaging in war against the illusory energy? It seems like at that point you're cooperating and you're trying to surrender to Krishna.
That's correct.
You're being a good guy and not a bad guy that should have to be punished and, it's retaliated against.
The reason is that we're not dealing with an ordinary person. We're dealing with the supreme person. His standards are supreme. And if we want to be in his inner circle, we have to elevate ourselves to his standard. And that's not an easy thing to do. Prabhupada gives the analogy, if you want to buy diamonds, you've got to be prepared to pay the price. Diamonds are very expensive. Instead, you can buy what they call in India, American diamond. American diamond means a cubic zirconia, right? So, you don't have to pay that much, but you don't have a real diamond either. If you want a diamond, you've got to pay for it. So Maya's business is to declare war on that person who declares war on her. Actually, her business is not to fight anyone, really. That's maybe not the best way to put it. Her purpose is to make sure that you meet Krishna's standards. And Krishna is the person who put her up to it, so you can talk to him about it. That's why in Vrindavan, they generally don't like to take shelter of Krishna so much as they take shelter of Srimati Radharani. Because in the last two questions, we've pointed at Krishna, haven't we? Krishna causes us suffering even when we go back to Godhead. But Srimati Radharani, she's very light. She's very soft-hearted. She's very merciful. How merciful? Prabodhananda Saraswati Thakur says, Vaidagta Sindhu, Anuragata Saika Sindhu, Vatsalya Sindhu. Vatsalya Sindhu. She is an ocean of parental love for the devotees who take shelter of her. Atisandra Kripaika Sindhu. She is a unique ocean of condensed compassion. Very highly concentrated mercy. And she's an ocean of that. You cannot find anything to compare with her. Rasayika Sindhu. So we take shelter of Srimati Radharani, but who are we to take shelter of Srimati Radharani? Therefore, we take shelter of her representatives. That is the Guru Parampara, and especially our own spiritual master. This is the point. If we take shelter of the spiritual master, then by his grace, mukam koroti vachalam pangum langhayate girim yet kripatam aham vande shri gurum dinataranam. A blind person can count the stars in the sky at night, assuming that it's not too polluted. And a lame person can hop over mountains. A dumb person who cannot speak is able to recite eloquent poetry. All that is possible. There's another nice verse in this connection. Vande Shri Gurudevam Tam Karuna Varunalayam. He's like an ocean of mercy, the spiritual master. Why? Because he represents Srimati Radharani. Prapta Sikalyana Guna, Arnava. And being an ocean of mercy, Karuna Varunalayam, Yat Kripa Lavale Shena Pamaropi Amarayate. Even a person who is actually an outcast, that person can become an immortal. By just a speck of his mercy, by a part of a drop of his mercy, you see. So I'm kind of meandering, but I hope it's answered your question. Okay, anything else? Okay, one more. She needs a microphone.
It's like few points, but one question. So first of all, about Nanda Yashoda, when they saw Kamsa kill first and second, why they continue to produce?
Take the microphone maybe half an inch further away, because your voice is distorting.
Better?
Yeah.
So when Nanda Yashoda, they saw that Kamsa kill first and second child, why they continue produce the children again and again?
Yeah, good question. First of all, it wasn't Nanda Yashoda, strictly speaking, it was Vasudeva and Devaki. Why they kept producing children if they knew they were going to be killed? Well, this is adrishta, this is destiny. It was so fated. Of course, this is transcendental destiny. It's part of the lila. But they had to have some sort of substantiation for that, don't they? They have to be able to justify basically throwing their kids into the fire, one after another, as it were. The justification is dharma. Householders should actually have children. In fact, it's so important because the householder's own deliverance depends on the piety of the children. When a person dies, the children are going to perform shraddha. That shraddha relieves a person in case that person has become a ghost, people who are too attached or people who die untimely in inauspicious circumstances, sometimes they become ghosts. In order to relieve a person from that potentiality, one has to perform shraddha ceremony. And one cannot do that unless the son has to do it, you see. So they met their obligations to produce children because it's the obligation of a householder.
Okay. Then if it's first child die, it was previous karma. For example, like what about second and third? It's new karma, or also all the seven killed children, it's previous karma. There is the new karma. There is the choice. When I make choice, it's
no,
my previous
dharma,
karma.
Dharma does not produce that kind of karmic reaction because dharma is punya. There are two things. There's dharma and there's papa or adharma. There's karma, which is dharma, and there's papa, which is adharma. You see, when you perform dharma, the reaction will always be elevating. Only through performing papa is the reaction suffering. You see, so the death of their children was not coming as a result of their immediate activities of procreation. It's coming from some, theoretically, it's coming from some vastly distant past.
Okay.
But in this case, it was actually coming from Krishna's will.
Okay, it was devotional service. But when I make choice, do good or do bad, that's my previous karma. If it's previous karma, then I have no choice.
You do have a choice because you don't have to act on what you're impelled, what you're influenced by. But it becomes harder not to be influenced. That's the point. I made this point that when we, let's take, for example, sinful reactions. When you commit a sinful activity, it solidifies in your heart the tendency to do that same thing again and again and again. It becomes much harder, you see? So, although theoretically you don't have to commit that activity, it's very, very difficult not to be impelled in that way, you see? But the choice is there. Someone said it's like this. When you put your hand in the fire, you don't have a choice about whether your hand is going to be burned. It will definitely be burned. But you don't have to put your hand in the fire, you see? But someone may be so conditioned that he just really wants to, he's very curious, what does fire feel like, right? So that person has to suffer. Bhrigupati had a question or a comment.
Poor memory, imagination. I thought I heard something once to the effect that one of the reasons why, or the reason why Vasudeva and Devaki kept having children was that they also were aware of the prediction, the eighth child would kill Kamsa, and they wanted to see Kamsa killed.
That's right.
So they felt like some obligation.
Let's expedite the matter.
Is that bona fide?
Yeah. There are many ways to answer that question. There are many different reasons why they did like this.
That's something that one of the acharyas says that I thought I heard that someplace, but I can't remember.
I don't have an explicit reference in my mind either, but it's okay. I think that's... Prem Sankirtan wants to say something. And then we have to go because it's late.
Is it like that then... More you are developing your devotion to Krishna, more is your destiny, your karma. Krishna is reducing your karma.
Yeah, karmani nirdahati kintu cha bhakti bhajam. Brahma Samhita tells us that for those who are on the bhakti path, for them the karma is either minimized or annulled altogether. But that's up to Krishna. Now for us, another adrishta thing here is that we don't know. We don't know whether we're suffering as a result of karma or whether we're suffering because of Krishna's mercy. Or we don't know that our karma has been minimized or whether it hasn't or whether it's been removed. We don't know. It's adrishta. It's adrishta. We can't see it. Okay? All right. We're going to have to go. It's late. Thank you very much. All glory to Prabhupada. Hare Krishna.
Just one.
Minimize your karma.
Yeah.
And erase it. Okay. Yeah. But because you're so sincere, he's going to give you suffering. Like if you define it, you can see. It's not like a Krishna neutralizes your karma according to that verse, because you're going to be free from suffering.
Now here's a secret. Therefore, somebody will be lucky. So there's no point. If I'm just going to get the same thing anyway, then I will continue in material life and not take shelter of Krishna. That indicates envy. A devotee won't think like that, but a karmi will think like that. Because he's envious.
It appears that all those devotees have been used to Krishna as an example for the whole world.
Take it from